The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Do we blow up an airfield? Do we blow up multiple airfields? Do we go after a wide array of targets that includes some ground forces? I think there'll be an attempt to link things to chemical weapons rather than tying it necessarily to the war. In terms of things that will have the biggest impact, anything that's going to have a big impact needs to be sustained. So if you're going to try to go after Assad's air force, they can try to protect some of the air defense and try to mitigate some of the damage some the Russians might guard effectively. Are you trying to say we're going to limit your use of conventional military forces against civilian targets, which means a lasting presence? Are we going to try to prop up what remains of the opposition and restore them? Again, that's a lasting train and equip program. So to have an impact, it's not just needs to be something big, but something that's sustained over time. And I think the Trump administration is very reluctant to go down that road. So we may see something bigger than last time. And the president himself, according to news reports, is pushing for that. But bigger, to me, will matter relatively little in the long term if we don't keep the pressure up.
I think it goes without saying, but that kind of commitment is the kind that would bring us squarely into trouble under the War Powers Resolution. And that may be one reason that you don't see serious discussion of that.
I'm Scott Anderson, and this is the Lawfare Podcast for April 14th, 2018. Friday evening, I sat down with Dan Byman, a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy here at the Brookings Institution, and Tess Bridgman, a former deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council and current affiliate of Stanford University's Center for International Security and Cooperation, for a late-breaking discussion on Syria. All week, President Trump has promised airstrikes in response to the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons, but so far nothing has come. Does this mean he's having second thoughts, or is this simply the calm before the storm? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 301, Taking Stock on Syria.
Well, let me just start by laying out some of the developments of the past week for folks who may not have been following it as closely. On April 7th, the Assad regime, we believe, executed a chemical attack in the city of Douma, not the first one that it's done recently, but one with a higher death toll, including a number of civilians. The Assad regime in Russia, of course, denied there's any evidence that there was chemical weapons involved. The UK, France, the United States claim to have evidence, or at least fairly persuasive evidence, that chemical weapons, including chlorine gas and potentially sarin nerve gas, was involved in the attack. And since Monday, President Trump has been going so far on Twitter as to threaten or at least promise a big response to the Assad regime and its allies in Russia and Iran for these sorts of actions. We've seen a lot of diplomacy on this front. There have been debates in the UN Security Council all this week. We've seen a lot of communications with allies in France and the UK who are more or less on board with a strong response to the Assad regime's actions. But we haven't seen any clear action or decision from the White House thus far. There have been a lot of reports about conversations going on within the White House, some people saying that there's tension between the Pentagon, who's less comfortable with a broad response, and the White House, particularly the new National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who had his first day on Monday and is, by some reports, pushing for a much broader, more aggressive, debilitating strike against Syria, although I think we should take all those with a grain of salt. But we still haven't seen a decision yet. Tessa, let me turn it to you first for kind of a procedural question, given your background on the National Security Council. At her press hearing earlier today, Sarah Huckabee Sanders indicated that there was still a deputies committee meeting scheduled for this afternoon to talk about what the response is going to look like. from your time at the NSC, what would that tell you about where we are in the decision-making about the set of issues?
Sure. Thanks, Scott. Well, it certainly would depend case by case. Some things move much more quickly through the process than others, and I'm sure there's some degree of urgency here, but a deputies committee meeting, as most of our listeners may already know, is generally not the last stage in the NSC process. So after deputies are convened, most likely with a situation that is as grave as this one, with the potential of ordering military strikes on a foreign sovereign nation, you'd at least convene the principals committee and then probably also have a National Security Council meeting, which is essentially the principals plus the president, before sending up a final set of options to the president for potential approval or disapproval. So the deputies committee certainly is, you know, a very important part of the process where a lot of the meatier issues are hashed out, where perhaps if new options are needed for consideration, they might be tasked out at the deputies level first to ensure all the relevant facts and kind of perspectives that all the departments and agencies have are brought to the table. But ordinarily, there would be some more process after that. Now, there certainly are situations where if the events are moving fast enough, something could go straight through up to the president with, you know, various mechanisms for ensuring that principals are on board and are brought in. But I think that would be pretty unlikely in a situation like this. And that is, of course, in the normal course, not having insight into how this particular National Security Council staff is running under the new National Security Advisor. We can't be sure whether that more or less normal battle rhythm is what's being followed here.
And one thing I think is worth noting is that the Trump administration kept in place, by my understanding, the deputies and principals committee structure that the Obama administration had early on. They did issued a National Security Presidential Memorandum 2, I think it was, that kind of kept that stuff in place. But we've seen some shifts under Bolton, and specifically in his move to replace Tom Bossert as a Homeland Security Advisor, which at least under that document wasn't a subsidiary role to John Bolton. So not usually somebody you could ask for their resignation for. So there may have been some change in that decision-making structure, but that's really useful insight. Dan, let me pivot to you. What do you attribute this sort of delay or more deliberative process to? Is it a strategic issue? Is it simply a necessity for logistics reason? What do you see entering into this sort of timing that we've seen that seems to run contrary to the timing that the president was projecting earlier?
A lot of the problem is that there simply aren't any good options for dealing with this. I think the president's advisors, or at least some of them, recognize that simply blowing up an airfield or otherwise doing a symbolic strike isn't actually going to do much. And it does enable the United States to, you know, feel that it stood up to a dictator who used chemical weapons against his own people. But in terms of actually stopping it the next time or otherwise affecting the battlefield, it's not going to have much impact. So what I would hope to see is that the president would be thinking about the question of what an impact would be. And the other thing is that Russia has made it clear that this could lead to a broader confrontation with Russia. And some of us would like to see the United States take a more aggressive stance on Russia, but that doesn't mean we want to blunder into it. It's not the sort of thing you want to do inadvertently, and you want to be prepared for Russia's response and have a response to that. And these are messy, complex, difficult issues that require a lot of planning. And so I think the delay, even if the United States is going to go forward, is sensible as long as it means that the response is going to be more carefully thought through.
Absolutely. Obviously, Russia, particularly since its intervention in Syria in 2015, but before, has been a major player, a major backer of the Assad regime. And we've seen them take measures to prevent inquiry or accountability about other chemical weapons attacks in the past, including by vetoing UN Security Council resolutions and other measures, as they did again Tuesday, vetoing a U.S.-backed Security Council resolution that, frankly, on its face, in my mind, seemed like a genuine effort at accountability, setting up an independent monitoring mechanism, you know, pushing back any consideration of use of force or any sort of responsive measures until after this investigation. In other words, kind of a good faith proposal on the part of the United States. That was my read, at least. But Russia really was aggressively pushed back against that, accused the United States of offering it simply as pretext for an intervention, and has generally taken a pretty hard line on at least some of this stuff. What is your sense, Dan, of Russia's kind of strategic thinking? How does this airstrike and its response to this airstrike more specifically fit into its broader strategic agenda in Syria?
Russia has played a mediocre hand very well in Syria. So it has used limited airstrikes and kind of small numbers of forces to have a fairly decisive impact on the ground. And in so doing, it's not only helped a key ally, the Assad regime,
get back on its feet, but it's also projected an image of credibility. People in the region believe Russia can get things done, even if they oppose it, and it's given Russia greater influence. And if you think about one of Putin's goals, which is to have Russia treated again as a great power, this has gone a long way towards doing this. You can't think about the Middle East today, and especially about the biggest conflict there, without thinking about Russia's role. So when it comes to the U.S. strike, Russia has to be able to say to its allies and even say to its enemies that the United States changed its policies, that it respected Russia, that even if it didn't attack, that because of Russia's presence, the U.S. did things differently in a way that at least worked to Russia's advantage or less to its disadvantage.
So a big part of this debate, at least, has played out this week at the UN Security Council resolution, as I mentioned earlier, in a lot of these debates. And there is this kind of multilateral part of what's been happening. In particular, we have seen that the OPCW, an organization that takes the lead on monitoring and pursuing accountability and reporting on chemical weapons, has sent a team to Syria. I believe that at least part of the team has arrived as of today and is supposed to begin work as of tomorrow. Tess, I wanted to ask you, you know, how do these multilateral bodies, these international institutions, fit into the picture here at this point? We've still seen a few UNSC meetings come in, and obviously they played a big role in 2013 when a similar sort of conflict between the United States and Russia ultimately led to a kind of negotiated deal. Do you see them playing a role here this time around?
Absolutely. I mean, going back to 2013, I think it's important to keep in mind when you have some people arguing that the so-called red line about CW use wasn't, quote, enforced back then because there wasn't a use of military force, that there absolutely was a response. And I think objectively, one that may have been far more effective than launching missiles at an airfield, and that was turning to first diplomacy with Russia and then the use of multilateral institutions to take a series of steps that ended up ridding Syria of its entire declared stockpile of chemical weapons that the U.S. under U.N. supervision ended up destroying and seeing Syria accede to the Chemical Weapons Convention. Now, obviously, that wasn't sufficient to resolve the issue, seeing as we've seen further chemical weapons attacks by Assad against his own people. But it was a show of multilateral action that was effective in getting rid of the worst and the largest amount of the chemical weapons that Assad then had on hand in the country. I think folks acknowledge that if those chemical weapons had fallen into the hands of some of the other parties to the various conflicts going on in Syria, that the consequences could have been absolutely devastating. Imagine, for example, if ISIL or Al-Qaeda had access to those stockpiles before they were destroyed. So certainly the role of the OPCW and the UN Security Council were absolutely vital in that process. These actions wouldn't have been able to happen without their institutional roles. Now that the OPCW has played that role since 2013, the fact-finding mission that's been set up has been active, I think we see more a continuation of the same rather than a lot of new avenues for, you know, additional forms of multilateral action. But I certainly think those multilateral institutions will continue to be engaged, hopefully in a similar way as they have been.
And, you know, pushing a little bit more on this multilateral question, you know, if we compare the Trump administration's actions this time to the last set of airstrikes it pursued against Syria in April 2017, that was a relatively small, limited number of strikes, but done with relatively limited fanfare, at least by my recollection. I don't recall there being extended debates about potential responses to the UN Security Council, as there has been this time. I don't recall there being a lot of advanced coordination with countries like the United Kingdom and France, both of whom have expressed support for a strong response, including potential military response this time around. And the Trump administration has, to its credit, at least in my view, been pretty active about reaching out and using these forums to try and build these forms of support. And has done so successfully, at least for the UK and France. From your experience testing government and working on kind of similar issues, how important is this kind of coalition building or allied building to the broader legitimacy and support for this sort of action? And what contribute this kind of change in tactic or approach on the part of the Trump administration too?
Well, that's a good question. It may go back to what Dan was saying earlier in terms of effectiveness, that certainly acting alone is never going to be viewed as effective or as legitimate as acting with allies. But I would just kind of put a pin in this discussion to say acting with allies may serve to further legitimize a U.S. response to the extent it's a military response, but wouldn't make it lawful absent UN Security Council authorization or a valid claim of self-defense. So I think we might be inching towards the type of situation that we saw in Kosovo that some like to use as a precedent for this kind of strike. I would note, though, that, of course, that is not a legal precedent. There was no legal rationale offered when NATO intervened in Kosovo, at least not on the front end. And similarly, when the strikes were taken last year by the Trump administration, there was no international law legal justification offered. And the unilateral nature of those strikes only served to make that more egregious in the eyes of those who believe that the rule of law is important to vindicate here, that enforcing a norm of international law by violating a norm of international law isn't the best way to set precedents in our international relations. So multilateralism certainly helps with legitimacy. It certainly presents a more united front. It may open up other policy options beyond the use of force, and that would certainly be commendable in my view, but certainly alone, acting with a few key allies rather than unilaterally wouldn't bring a use of military force in these circumstances in line with international law.
If I could chime in on the multilateralism point, what I'd like to stress is that one of the biggest problems that the United States has had in its Syria policy is that it's often been working at cross purposes with its allies. Now, in some cases, our allies have dramatically different interests from one another and from the United States. They, for many years, were more focused on fighting Assad than on fighting the Islamic State, for example. In some cases, like Turkey, you have very particular concerns about the Kurds, while the United States has been working with them to fight the Islamic State. But the biggest problem recently has simply been that there's been no attempt to coordinate allies. So you at times have allies who want to do the same thing, who want to work together, but the United States is not trying to lead them effectively. And that to me has been one of the biggest frustrations, is the reluctance of the United States to engage with some of its allies in the region in a sustained way. And this has shown up not only in Syria policy, but elsewhere.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And actually, you know, there are a lot of other actors that are involved in Syria that have a vested interest in different aspects of Syria. And two of them are traditional allies of the United States. There's Israel that has been involved in its own airstrikes in Syria, primarily against Iran-associated entities that are also there supporting the Assad regime as recently as this past Sunday, I believe it was. And then we also have Turkey, which, of course, has been, as you mentioned, a little bit loggerheads with the United States, more recently over the United States' relationship with the Syrian Democratic Forces and a Kurdish-associated groups that Turkey's hostile to, but certainly traditionally is a NATO ally and a strong ally and has been in the past around counter-ISIL efforts in Syria. How does the airstrike going to fit into those relationships?
Well, Israel in particular would like to see the United States involved in the Middle East. Israel has relied on the United States as its vital security partner, and they were disheartened when Obama tried to limit the U.S. role in regional conflicts and in general tried to kind of put the Middle East more on the back burner, in part because a strong U.S. in the Middle East, they felt benefited Israel. So Israel would welcome it. I think they'd welcome it more if it were linked to some sort of broader effort rather than a one-off strike. But they do want to see the United States involved and were worried about the possibility that the United States would withdraw its ground troops as a signal that the United States in general would be moving back. Turkey is a bit more complex. Turkey has been trying to work more, at least reduce the enmity with Russia, for example. It's been trying to look for alternatives in the United States, and that's in part because of differences on the Syria policy and the Kurds, but also because the U.S. has been more critical of Turkey because of the growing authoritarianism there. And in general, this alliance, while certainly not a disaster, is certainly weaker than it was a while back. And another country I'll throw into the mix is Saudi Arabia, which also has wanted to see the United States play a strong role. But part of this is the U.S. has, in recent years under Obama and also under Trump, focused primarily on countering the Islamic State. And the allies have been more focused on the overall regional dynamics, as you'd expect, because it's their neighborhood. So Israel worries about weapons going to the Lebanese Hezbollah. It worries about Iran gaining a lasting, significant presence in Syria. Turkey worries about its border security. And understandably, you know, they care more about this than the United States does, which is focused on international terrorism. So this has led to, I can say, tensions, but also a big difference in caring, where they felt the need to become involved directly, while the United States has often had the luxury of being able to step back.
I think it's worth noting that I think as recently as the end of last week, we saw high-ranking Israeli officials explicitly encouraging the United States to get more involved in Syria or to remain actively involved in Syria, opposed to the Assad regime, which is struck me at least as not an unexpected position, but a dramatic measure to happen at that high and explicit and public a level. But we also have, in addition to kind of our nest of traditional allies and friends, even if they're not always in perfect alignment, there's a similar sort of coalition on arguably the other side. Although, again, I think it's a little more complex than that. We've talked a lot about Russia. Obviously, Russia has major interests in Syria, but there's also Iran in Syria. And on top of that, the Assad regime, which is highly dependent upon Iran and Russia, but also to some extent, at least in certain areas, has its own kind of independent interests. I'd be curious, Dan, about your sense of how these airstrikes is going to intersect with their own internal relationships. Are they all on the same page? Or is it going to bring out particular tensions between those three allies and their individual interests within Syria?
If it's just a one-off airstrike, even if it blows up lots of things, it's probably not going to have a big impact. They're anticipating this. They've seen it before. Given the carnage of the civil war, a U.S. airstrike that kills dozens of people or blows things up isn't a particularly, you know, bad week as far as these countries are concerned. Iran has lost people very recently to an Israeli strike. So the United States doing a bombing, which will get a lot of press here, is often just part of background noise for this. And in fact, it may bring them together because there'll be a sense of a common adversary that people are going after them. But there is genuine difference here. These countries are obviously in it to prop up the Assad regime, but there will be questions, and frankly, especially now that the Assad regime is emerging triumphant, there'll be questions about what next, what's the Iranian role. Russia will have to ask itself, doesn't want to stay tied in this region forever. So there'll be some new tensions that are likely to emerge as this moves forward.
And, you know, we have seen an interesting dialogue kind of between the United States and Russia that's kind of popped up, facilitated by Turkey, at least according to some media reports, as this deliberation has been ongoing, under the kind of rubric of deconfliction, a very common practice in other aspects of U.S. activities in Syria, where there's been an effort to, by my understanding from media reports, identify targets where the impact on Russia's personnel and equipment, but particularly personnel, would be less, but still be a valid target to accompany the mission, essentially, you know, establishing measures that might be less likely to escalate U.S.-Russian tensions. What do you make of that, Dan? Is that a major step? Is it something that's going to be ultimately undermine the effectiveness of any strikes? How much wisdom is there in pursuing that in this sort of scenario?
Well, it depends what you value more. Do you value sending a message to the Assad regime and having a big impact, or do you value containing escalation with Russia? So part of the negotiation, the back and forth with Russia, will be to make sure that the strike isn't something that's going to lead to tremendous escalation that ends up hurting the United States, that Russia does have cards to play and the United States is leery of them, and especially, frankly, the Trump administration, which at least for its time in office has been, you know, very, very leery of anything smacking of a confrontation with Russia and, in fact, has gone out of its way to accommodate Russia. All that said, when you do that, you're putting limits on the strike. You're telegraphing things. You're providing advance warning for the Assad regime. So it has less impact and enables them to absorb it more easily.
Tess, let me come back to you. And I want to go back to the international law and domestic law issues that you raised about kind of the lawfulness of different U.S. options or actions here. You know, as far as I'm aware, the Trump administration hasn't come out and said, this is what our legal justification will be if we are to take action. But we do have a useful guide in the April 2017 strikes that I mentioned before. As I believe you referenced, they came out and said, at least as a matter of domestic law, we believe that we have the authority to do this under the president's authority under Article 2 of the Constitution. We don't need congressional authorization. We think that by eliminating or at least deterring the Assad regime's ability to use chemical weapons, that we are serving regional stability and humanitarian interests that are in the vital interests of the United States. And this came up, interestingly, yesterday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee around Secretary of State nominee Pompeo's confirmation hearing, where he was asked by a number of senators on this issue. A few senators pushed back and said, no, this requires congressional authorization. But a number, including the chairman, Bob Corker, said, well, a surgical strike like they pursued, the Trump administration pursued in April 2017, probably doesn't need authorization. But other strikes, something more dramatic, something longer, a broader campaign would. What's your take on these sorts of legal arguments, the degree to which they're being accepted or not accepted by members of Congress, by people in the public? And what sort of precedent does this set if the Trump administration does choose to move forward with these sorts of strikes on this legal domestic legal basis?
Sure. So we'll set aside the international law question for a moment, which I think may be even harder, but certainly the domestic law question is not without controversy itself. So I think that what you're referencing here, the kind of two-part test that's been used by OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel at DOJ, for many years now and was relied on by the Obama administration in several instances, it goes something along these lines. And it's the president can constitutionally initiate military action without prior congressional approval if two conditions are met. One, the use of force serves significant national interests, and two, that the operations won't be of the kind of nature, scope, and duration to constitute war in the constitutional sense, which would require a declaration of war by Congress under the Declaration of War Clause. So here, I think what we have is some members of Congress at least saying, this does seem to me to serve a significant national interest. That interest, you know, it's not entirely clear what that is here, but based on some of the things that you've heard administration officials saying, as well as the things they said around April of 2017, it seems to be interests like promoting regional stability, but probably even more so this idea of enforcing a ban on chemical weapons use as a weapon in armed conflict. The issue of whether these types of strikes would constitute war in the constitutional sense can also be tricky. And I think, you know, some have argued that the combination of saying this type of strike both has a sufficient U.S. national interest and doesn't constitute war in the constitutional sense really makes Article 2 astonishingly broad to authorize essentially whatever a president would want it to. And I think going back to that second prong, if you look at what the nature, scope, and duration would be, it goes back to this question that Dan was talking about earlier. What is the actual strategy here? What are these strikes intended to accomplish? If in fact it is going to be a broad enough, a sustained enough campaign to ostensibly move the needle in Assad's use of chemical weapons or to accomplish other goals in the conflict, then you get arguably much closer, if not actually crossing the line, to what would constitute, quote, war in the constitutional sense. Whereas if you have one of these one-off kind of limited strikes, similar to the type we saw last April, it's at least an easier argument to make, although certainly not a slam dunk. There are many who would disagree that those kinds of strikes don't constitute war given their limited nature, scope, and duration. So the argument is certainly not without controversy, but it is one that's been relied on now by the Trump administration and by the Obama administration, indeed going all the way back to Bosnia. So it seems as though we have at least some members of Congress wanting to acquiesce, if you will, in that constitutional argument, while others in terms of vindicating institutional prerogatives say, no, this would be a strike on a foreign sovereign. Bringing in that there's no international legal justification would only strengthen, I think, in their minds, that you'd really need to come to Congress first before taking this kind of action. One of the reasons you might not see that happening, well, two reasons. One, first and foremost, is that those who seem to be articulating a belief that this constitutional argument is viable here are the ones in control of the relevant committees, right? So if Senator Corker of the SFRC believes that the president has all the authority he needs under Article 2 of the Constitution, you're not going to see that body pick up the debate around statutory authorization. I think the second reason that we're all very familiar with in the counter-ISIL context as well is that it's very unlikely that you'd get agreement in SFRC, let alone more broadly, as to what an authorization for the use of force should look like. If we couldn't agree on it in the counter-ISIL context, where everyone recognized a very grave threat by an organized terrorist group, it's extremely unlikely that we'd get to agreement on what kind of authorization Congress should provide in striking a foreign sovereign that is likely to bring the United States into a direct military confrontation with other military superpowers, namely Russia. So for both of those reasons, I think you'll end up seeing what looks like acquiescence in the constitutional question, even though it certainly will remain contested.
And at least by my understanding, and certainly the 2011 Libya OLC opinion, which I think is the most recent kind of comprehensive OLC view on this, you know, it kind of makes the point that this is all assuming that Congress has been silent on this issue, not in the necessarily in the face of opposed legislation. I think it's worth noting simply because we do still have the War Powers Resolution, of course, from 1973, which sets some restrictions on the use of force, which would make it difficult or at least more contentious potentially and on less sound legal ground if a campaign were to extend past a 60-day framework without securing congressional authorization. Although I'm not clear that that's on the table under any of these options that are actually being considered. Let's go back to the international law basis question that you raised, the harder question. Of course, under international law, under the UN Charter, states generally aren't allowed to use force against other states unless authorized by the UN Security Council or in their own self-defense against an imminent threat of some sort or an armed attack. How does this fit into this framework? You mentioned the Trump administration hasn't offered international law justification for its April 2017 strikes. Not clear it will do so now. How does that decision fit in, both in regards to how the legal framework applies to this any part of action here, but more broadly for the international legal system regulating the use of force?
Well, I think the short answer to your first question, Scott, in my view, is that it doesn't, that there simply isn't an international legal justification for the use of force against Syria in this context. You laid out the bedrock prohibition here, the prohibition enshrined in Article 2.4 of the UN Charter. We're actually talking about a prohibition and not just whether there's a rule on point that could justify the action. The prohibition says all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. So here, I think it's pretty much indisputable in mainstream international legal analysis that this would be a use of force against the territorial integrity of another state. Now, the two exceptions to that general rule are the ones that you already stated, Scott, UN Security Council authorization or a valid claim of self-defense. Well, we certainly don't have UN Security Council authorization, and we're not going to see it anytime soon, given Russia's veto, one of the permanent five members of the Security Council. We also, though, don't have a plausible claim of self-defense. Assad simply has not attacked the United States and has also not threatened to do so. So I think the argument actually is relatively clear-cut, and I think that's why you haven't seen the United States, at least in the executive branch, trying to offer a justification under international law. So in April of 2017, when the airstrikes that you mentioned were undertaken, there was an effort to justify them under domestic law, right? So you did see the Trump administration saying that there was constitutional authority to engage in these strikes as a matter of domestic law, but you did not see a basis offered under international law. Even though you have seen the Trump administration more or less continue the Obama administration's practice of offering international law justifications for its uses of force in basically all other contexts. So in the use of force against ISIL, but also, you know, everywhere else that is a theater of military activity, as reported, for example, in the administration's supplemental consolidated war powers reporting, you see an international law justification for those uses of force. The fact that there was none offered here for these counter-Assad strikes, I think, is all the proof you need that even the administration does not believe these strikes were lawful as a matter of international law. Now, I think that starts then to get to your second question, Scott, of what that means for the international legal order. I tend to have the view that the idea that we can enforce a norm of international law, even one as important as the non-use of chemical weapons in armed conflict, by violating international law, and in fact, by violating kind of the bedrock principle that provides order in the international sphere, is incredibly dangerous. And you can look at a lot of examples where very important international law norms were transgressed, and the knee-jerk reaction wasn't, well, we have to use force or else this norm will cease to have import. So when Russia invaded Ukraine, as an example, you know, you didn't see a serious discussion of, well, you know, we really need to invade back or else aggression will cease to have meaning as a norm in international law, right? Instead, you had a concerted multilateral effort to first condemn the action, to explain why it was unlawful, but then also to impose these really biting multilateral sanctions that Russia is still trying to get itself out from under and that have had an incredible impact on the economy. So I certainly think there's a very real and valid impulse that the international community must do something in the face of such egregious and murderous activity by the Assad regime, particularly seeing as it's been repeated. But that doesn't mean that the reaction has to be a use of military force. And in fact, I would argue that a use of military force in this context would weaken the norms on which the international system relies more than it would strengthen them.
And I think that argument's been well taken. It's kind of led to this very robust debate around these issues, which probably more than we have time here for. It's another podcast. But certainly one factor I think gives you a quick view on, at least in regards to the April 2017 strikes, didn't result in a big international backlash. In fact, there's a fair amount of silence, if not kind of tacit endorsement of a lot of those actions, which poses its own challenge to, I think, these sorts of norms and regulations in regard to state conduct.
I think it does go to this point that the international community does want to see consequences for Assad's actions. You know, you did see the whole reaction on the part of certainly some states that, again, the geopolitics are really what we see playing out here. But Russia, for example, called those strikes aggression against a sovereign state in violation of international law. Certainly Syria said similar things. And I think, you know, the fact that we did not offer an international legal justification may also play in a little bit here, just in terms of the kind of on the state practice and opinio iuris side of, do we see a norm developing that this kind of strike actually is lawful? I think if we had tried to justify it, you may have seen states responding, saying, no, actually, we want to make clear that we don't embrace that norm of international law as one that exists, right? So if we had seen a claim of humanitarian intervention, we'd seen claims of any sort of legality rather than legitimacy, you may have seen states come out of the woodwork a little bit more to say, I agree that Assad needs to have consequences for his actions, but let me be on record that our state does not view X or Y justification as a norm of customary international law. Almost because you didn't have a legal basis being claimed, you may have seen states feel that they didn't need to go on record and make those kinds of statements in response.
Dan, let me turn back to you now that I've subjected you and our listeners to the pain of having two lawyers talk to each other about a legal issue, and get back to the kind of core policy issues here. You know, for better or for worse, regardless of legal issues or policy concerns, it seems like there's kind of a few menu of options that are being considered by the Trump administration on kind of a spectrum ranging from more punitive strike, a lot like the April 2017, that's a bit of a slap on the hand, limited, to a variety of measures that are meant to both be a little more painful to the Assad regime and possibly to debilitate its ability to use chemical weapons or take actions in the future, all the way to something much more severe that would be more broadly debilitating to the Assad regime in a variety of capacities, like taking out its air force to the fullest extent possible. How feasible or advisable do you see these different options from a policy perspective? Where do they fit in regards to the variables we've talked about the other actors at play in Syria, these other policy concerns, which ones are actually on the table?
I think for the most part, it's a limited strike, but the question is how limited. So do we blow up an airfield? Do we blow up multiple airfields? Do we go after a wide array of targets that includes some ground forces? I think there'll be an attempt to link things to chemical weapons. So it might be units or command and control, but all with the statement that there's some linkage to this broader program rather than tying it necessarily to the war. In terms of things that will have the biggest impact, what I would stress is anything that's going to have a big impact needs to be sustained. So if you're going to try to go after Assad's Air Force, they can try to protect some of the air defense and try to mitigate some of the damage some the Russians might guard effectively. Do you keep assets in the region and let them know if you fly, we're going to shoot it down? And that would mean near continual presence. Are you trying to say we're going to limit your use of conventional military forces against civilian targets, which again means a lasting presence? Are we going to try to prop up what remains of the opposition and restore them? Again, that's a lasting train and equip program. So to have an impact, it's not just needs to be something big, but something that's sustained over time. And I think the Trump administration is very reluctant to go down that road. So we may see something bigger than last time. And the president himself, according to news reports, is pushing for that. But bigger, to me, will matter relatively little in the long term if we don't keep the pressure up.
And by keeping the pressure up and keeping this sort of presence, are you talking about really folks on the ground, a kind of ground military presence, or is this something that may be achievable primarily by air power, but just requires a more concerted policy effort?
It depends what we want to do. So air power certainly can do a lot, but it's not going to protect civilians on the ground in a serious way. So it might mean that they can't bomb them, but you can still use artillery, you can still use ground troops, you can still go in and kill them in a host of other ways. So for the civilians on the ground to know that they're not going to be killed by a plane flying over, but they might be killed by artillery is really not too much comfort. So there are going to be limits if we try to do things by air power only. And this is an old line by Elliot Cohn of Seiss. He wrote that air power is like modern courtship. It offers gratification without commitment. And that lack of commitment can be dangerous if we think we're trying to shape things on the ground.
I think it goes without saying, but that kind of commitment is the kind that would bring us squarely into trouble under the War Powers Resolution, even as a domestic law matter. And that may be one reason that you don't see serious discussion of that, in addition to, of course, all of these policy reasons having to do with escalation and also just a lack of appetite to go down that path of confrontation.
And I think it's also worth noting that if we drift beyond an effort to stem humanitarian offenses and to prevent or deter the Assad regime from using chemical weapons in our purposes, broader kind of an effort to destabilize the Assad regime more generally, that also drifts further from even the legitimacy justification that the Trump administration has argued kind of at the international level, not a legal argument, but legitimacy argument, and is kind of new territory, if nothing else, that they haven't touched on directly. So certainly new challenges there as well. But Dan, your comment about this lasting presence and this endurance, I think is a really interesting one because it harkens to my favorite phrase to come out of Syria policy in the last few months, which is this idea of the enduring presence, which is the other half of U.S. policy that we, at least until recently, were pursuing about you keeping troops that currently are in eastern and northeastern Syria working with the Syrian Democratic Forces I mentioned earlier, which is this kind of primarily Kurdish group that's been working with us in counter-ISIS efforts. And in January this past year, then-Secretary of State Tillerson said, we intend to keep U.S. troops there kind of indefinitely, really working with the SDF, both on the ground and probably more importantly, providing air cover for them, both to combat ISIL, but then Tillerson kind of framed it also as an effort to hedge against Iranian and Russian and Assad regime influence and recovery. Although subsequent State Department, Defense Department officials rolled that back a little bit, really emphasized the counter-ISIL mission. That was kind of the rough plan, although different parts of it got emphasized and mentioned in different contexts in different ways, up until about 2 or 3 weeks ago when the Trump administration, President Trump specifically, indicated fairly out of the blue that no, in fact, U.S. troops are going to be pulling out of Syria once the counter-ISIL mission is finished. Not really clear what that means in regards to finished. And then not only said that about U.S. troops, but then suspended U.S. stabilization funds that were originally supposed to be going to Syria in the near term. So in light of that, we've got this other whole set of Syria policy. How are the airstrikes going to intersect with that area of policy?
And this is the broader problem, which is we have absolutely no coherence in our policy. So the president is saying, we did a great job against the Islamic State and now we should get out. And then he's saying that we should be hammering Assad. The military is pushing for the idea of a longer, more sustained presence. We're trying to balance the Turks and the Kurds. And we haven't had that serious discussion about priorities and what we want to do. And conversely, what we're not going to do. So it's extremely difficult to kind of try to do all this at once, because you end up with the worst result. You end up with incoherence, and our enemies are not deterred. Our enemies are not changing their policies, and our allies don't trust the United States to see things through. And I can see advantages to leaving. I could see advantages to doubling down. But we seem to be trying to do both at once. And there's a wishful thinking going on, which is that we can really teach Assad a lesson. We can keep the Islamic State down, and we can do all this on the cheap without getting involved in the region. And that's simply impossible.
Well, let me pose one last question to you all before we part. You both are people who've worked in government, spent a lot of time advising government officials. What advice would you give to President Trump and his team, or members of Congress, other people involved in the decision-making process around U.S.-Syria policy, regards to the best way forward, both on a policy and a legal front? Dan, why don't I go ahead and start with you?
So on the policy side, I would try to do something extremely difficult, which is try to think very hard about what the United States wants to achieve in Syria, and equally important, what it's willing to do to achieve that. And from there, try to work in circles, right? So how can we get our allies to contribute to this, both to make the policy more effective and to reduce the cost? How our adversary is going to respond, and how will we respond to their responses? How long are we willing to sustain this? Can we get Congress to support it? Can we get the American people to support it? And I don't think we're having these hard questions. We're treating this as a one-off issue because of the chemical weapons use, when that's simply part of this broader horrific conflict that's tied to so many other issues. And in the Obama administration, perhaps endlessly, there were interagency meetings discussing all this. And it did lead to a policy many people were critical of. But the president made clear he wanted to limit U.S. involvement in Syria, but focus heavily on the Islamic State. Now, in some ways, we've seen the fruit of that. The Islamic State has been hit very hard, but there are broader questions about what we want to do in Syria and how to think about the remnants of the Islamic State. And I don't think the Trump administration has had those hard discussions.
I'd like to make this very easy by associating myself completely with Dan's comments. I think he's really hit the nail on the head. The incoherence of the current strategy is certainly manifest. I completely agree that we seem to be trying to have it both ways, and that's probably going to lead to failure on all fronts rather than success on all fronts. But I'd also just, in kind of one last point, say that I sympathize with the Trump administration in at least one respect, which is that I think there are no good answers at this point. You're choosing between various bad outcomes, various bad policy options, with no clear guarantee of success, no matter what you pick. And I think focusing on counter-ISIL made a lot of sense, both because it's the more lawful goal, as for all the reasons we've discussed, but also because there was a clearer policy objective, and there was a set of allies who would do it with us, and there was a legitimacy to that policy approach that I think you're just simply not going to see with the other strands of this conflict and the actors now involved and the position we all now find ourselves in. So while we certainly can all agree that there needs to be more policy coherence, that these hard problems need to be discussed, that they need to be aired in Congress, and that Congress needs to step up and play its part as well, I don't think that should give any of us any kind of reason to think that any solution would be easy, or that any of these problems have a clear path forward that, but for our inability to see them, we would have already embraced.
Well, it's certainly a difficult set of issues facing the Trump administration and our country. But for Lawfare listeners, I will say we're lucky to have you two to help us walk through it and think about our options. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining me today.
Thank you, Scott.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet, share, or like the Lawfare podcast, and give it a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you may have found us. As always, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.